Now, last night, we dealt with verses 1 to 4, a call to unity. Then, from verse 5 onward, we noted that the rest of the chapter was devoted to the mind of Christ. Last night, we dealt with the mind of Christ exhibited in the Lord himself, verses 5 to 11. Now, the rest of the chapter is the same. Verses 12 to 16, the mind of Christ exhibited in the assembly at Philippi. It reads like this. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation or generation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. The mind of Christ exhibited in the assembly at Philippi. Now verses 17 and 18. The mind of Christ seen in the Apostle Paul. Yea, and if I be offered upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. For the same cause also do ye joy and rejoice with me. The mind of Christ seen in Paul. Verses 19 to 24, the mind of Christ displayed in Timothy. Reads like this. But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timotheus, shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's. But ye know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he hath served with me in the gospel. Him therefore I hope to send presently, so soon as I shall see how it will go with me. But I trust in the Lord, that I also myself shall come shortly. The mind of Christ displayed in Timothy. Finally, verses 25 to 30, the mind of Christ displayed in Epaphroditus. Yet I suppose it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, companion in labor, and fellow soldier, but your messenger, and he that ministered to my want. For he longed after you all, and was full of heaviness, because that ye had heard that he had been sick. For indeed he was sick nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I sent him therefore the more carefully, more diligently, quickly, that when ye see him again, ye may rejoice, and that I may be the less sorrowful. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, and hold such in reputation, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service to what are. So the Lord will bless the reason.
back to nest. Last night,
we dealt with the early part of the chapter, in which we saw that Paul was calling for oneness, for holiness, for a concern for others. Then we took time to detail that amazing passage from verses 5 to 8, in which we trace Christ coming from Godhead glory, laying aside the insignia of his majesty, and coming down to where we were. He came in the form of a servant, the reality of his manhood. He became in the likeness of men, the uniqueness of his manhood. He was found in fashion as a man, the acceptability of his man. And then, as a man, down here on earth, he humbled himself and became obedient right on to death, even the death of the cross. And we had quite a number of pertinent things to say about the mind of Christ in each one of us. That mind that is prepared to sacrifice our lives for others. Prepared to go out of our way to help other people. Not so much living here to plow a course for ourselves, but just to sacrifice life for others. You'll notice constantly two themes coming in through this epistle, not so often mentioned. This theme of sacrificial living, this challenge to unity and oneness amongst us. You can't set it aside. We'll need to face that life should not be as comfortable as it now is. And separation, division amongst us should not be as it now pertains. It is all on the whole a betrayal of the purity of divine truth. There's a day of account coming for it all, brethren. While I know that in many places and countries things have been inherited from previous generations, nevertheless, the present application in all its pertinence of divine truth must be faced up by every generation. You must live your life for his glory or pay the price in the day of the view. And you can make your choice. You can be something or nothing. You can be big or small. I don't mean to say a big public man or anything like that, but just where you are, you can live your life and give it for God and Christ, as we shall see tonight, in local circumstances. We got down just to the opening of verse 9, God exalted Christ. You see, the man that humbled himself, God exalted. The man that didn't try to cut a name for himself, God gave him a name above every name. The man that bowed his knee in lowly service to others, God has decreed that every knee shall bow to him. The man who used his tongue to pour out gracious words of compassion and rebuke, then God has decreed that every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Don't argue about your Bible. God never gave you the Bible to argue about. Whether you think the name above every name is Jesus, or whether you think that it's Jehovah, or whether you think, like the present speaker, that it's a name of renown, whichever it may be, let this be sure, that God has decreed that a day is coming when everyone in the universe shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. That is not primarily salvation, that's subjugation. Every being, notice verse 10, that every being in heaven, earth, and under the earth shall confess his name. Every being in heaven, celestial realm. Every being on earth, terrestrial realm. Every being under the earth, the infernal realm. The whole of the universe shall unite to pay tribute to Christ, and whether they are rebels to all eternity, everyone shall be forced to confess that which is the theme of the gospel.
that Jesus Christ is Lord and all to the ultimate glory of God the Father. You may bear reproach for him now. One day the whole universe shall confess the name of the one that we love. What is it? Now, in verses 12 to 16, in our words, in order to show how this mind of Christ can be manifested in a local assembly, in verses 12 and 13, he is dealing with working out what he calls salvation. And in verses 14 to 16, he's telling us how we can shine and speak. Got that? Now look at verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only when I was with you, but now in my absence when I am no longer with you, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. That's the outward thing. Verse 13, the inward thing, for it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Now, I think I would be right. The normal exposition is that here in verse 12, you're working out the salvation that you've got inwardly. That it refers to your personal salvation. And you'll work that out in your life into holiness and reverential fear of God. Now, of course, that is a true thing. I don't think it's true. I think the salvation here is assembly salvation. I think it's dealing with assembly problems. Paul was saying, listen, you've got your problems. We've been talking about them. Now he says, listen, my brethren, when I was with you, I was able to help you. Apostolic wisdom was available to you, but now I'm absent. And we are in the same position then as the Philippians. Apostolic wisdom is no longer with us unless in the inspired writings. We are living in days where there are no apostles despite false claims. There were only 13 apostles directly commissioned by Christ, and every one of them had seen Christ. There are no others. Ephesians 2 verse 20 is perfectly clear. The foundation of the church was built upon the ministry of apostles and prophets in that order. They were in the foundation and laid the foundation. They are not in the 20th story. Come now, please. So that I think that in verse 12, he's saying now, listen, you'll need to work out your own problem. This will be to your salvation and benefit. Work out your assembly salvation with all the problems. You've got to work at them. Got that. They won't go away. Don't put your head in the sand. You'll need to work at them. And he says, you can work out this salvation with fear and trembling. With fear, lest in any way you displease the Lord. Trembling as you recognize the awesome majesty of the Lord of the assemblies. Whether you believe that's what the passage teaches, every assembly's had to face this. That you've got to work it out. You've got to handle it. And you've got to handle it in fear and trembling, not arrogantly. Not laying down the law, but with the fear of God in your soul. Because as I said another night, when the first night, on bishops and deacons, overseers and servants, ultimately and finally, any decision by an assembly, we are claiming that's the decision of the Lord. Tremendous thing. We act for him. Now he says, listen, verse 13. Power is available for you. That's a great thing. God would never ask you to do a thing without giving you power to do it. He says it is God that worketh in you, both to will and to do his good pleasure. So that even in assembly matters, the good pleasure of the Lord is before you. Power, internal power, will be granted to you to do it for God's glory. It's God that worketh in you. It's the internal operation of divine power by the Spirit that will enable you to work out your assembly problems for the pleasure of God and for the delight of God. Have you got it? Work out your own salvation. Get down to it and solve your own problems. That phrase, look now at verses 14 to 16. Now he says, in all this, you don't do it by murmurings and disputings. Have you got that? No murmurings. No mutterings. No wranglings. No disputings. No arguments. No coming together in your little groups, as I said the other night, and feeding on each other's resentment against someone or someones. These are the things that's destroying assembly life, making assembly problems difficult. Breaking up in little groups, in which you all agree on certain things and you feed that resentment in each other. Terrible thing. You would think these things were never in your Bible. Do all things without murmurings and disputing. Verse 15, what you are. You're blameless, you're harmless, you're without fault. Now notice, please, will you, central to it all, you are the sons of God. You are the children of God. Now never forget that. You are those who represent God. He's given you dignity and status. He says, always remember in every situation, and especially in your local assembly, that you are there as the sons of God. You've got that. And you're there to represent God. You are not Adam's church, wherever you are. You never were asked to represent brethrenism or any otherism. You're here to represent the Godhead. Now get your dignity clear. And remember, they may call you all kinds of brethren and give you names. Remember, please, we are the sons of God. That's our dignity. We never attained to that. God made us that the night we were converted. Now he says, I've made you that, you be that. So as the sons of God, we don't murmur and dispute. He says, you are the people that are blameless. Now that doesn't mean to say you're perfect or you're sinless. But we are... A blameless person is one against whom no charge can be laid. We are irreproachable. We're not perfect, but we're blameless. You can't point the finger at us. We are harmless. We are guileless. We are pure. No impure motives. No guile. No planning to undermine something or be against someone. We are without rebuke. We are without fault. We are people who live like the sons of God. Have you got the idea? Is it clear? He says, come again now. For he says you're living in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. That world outside Now you be careful about your contacts with it. For it's bent. It's twisted. It's crooked. It's not straight up and down. They're not marked by righteousness. It's perverse. It's perverted. It's depraved. It's sinful. The less you have to do with it, the better. And the less you have to do with the ungodly, the better. They are entirely opposite to what we are. You see, when you get a person who's blameless and guileless and without fault, you've got a good friend. Now listen to me. Now please. Don't you think that your friends are the friends that tell you the things you want to hear? Invariably, these are not your friends. You think they are. Your real friends are the friends that tell you the truth. Whether it hurts or not, that's your real friend. You believe these sort of things. I know it's not true to the way we go on, but that's true. Your real friends are the friends that will take you aside and tell you kindly but firmly the truth about yourself. He won't try to feed your pride and your ego and tell you the things that he knows you want them to say. In fact, I have found in life very often the best friends are the friends who would say, now listen, you're taking the wrong road and you're doing the wrong thing. That's a true friend. So here we are. Just planted where we are in our own Philippi. In our own locality. We are the people who are blameless, harmless, without fault. Now watch now, the close of verse 15. And we are the people who shine as stars, as luminaries in the world. Now think of it. Think of Toronto tonight. It's dark. Oh, it's lit up and the neon lights are flashing. But in the eyes of God, it is dark. It's black. And the sons of God are shining. And the lampstands are giving the light, the local assemblies. We are shining as lights and luminaries. In the darkness of this world, lighting it up as we go through. You see, if this is true, then it means you would recognize every Christian for their light, and everything else is dark. Now, would that be right? God knows I want to help you. We're not like them. And we don't want to be like them. And we don't want their company. And we don't want their fellowship. But we'll serve them to the last drop of our blood to help them. We'll be friendly, but they're not our friends. Got it? Lights in the darkness. And at lower verse 16, you not only shine, but you speak. You live. You're holding forth the word of life. That's it. We shine in our lives and speak with our lips. Isn't that right? You believe in this lip and life, don't you? You believe in the impact of consecrated personality. And you believe in the power of the spoken word, don't you? The word of life, the gospel. He says, holding forth the word of life. Watch now. Says Paul, if you live like that, because I have spent so much labor on you, you are saved through my preaching. I saw you baptized, I saw you gathered. I want you to live as you ought to live. And he says, if you do that, now listen to this, he says, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ at the judgment seat, that I have not run in vain nor labored in vain. That all the expenditure of life and strength and energy and talent has not been in vain. Because you've lived as the Christians ought to live. That's good. You see, there is a day of account coming. day of Christ. Every day you'll need to be given account for. Maybe you don't like the preachers that tell you the things you shouldn't do. I tell you, in that day you'll realize the preachers were right. You maybe don't care for it straight from the shoulder. I tell you, in that day, if you listen and believe and live, you'll bow at that judgment seat to be crowned by Christ. Paul says, I'll rejoice in that day because I haven't labored in vain. Tell me, why do you think that I would say to you, I'm expecting results from these meetings in Toronto this month? I'm not preaching the gospel, I'm teaching the word of God, but I expect results. Lives to be changed. Character to be molded. A vow of consecration now. The past is over with. I'm finished with it. I'm out and out for Christ. I've told you before, you'll lose a few friends. You'll be the better of losing them. Some Christians are not too good company. Beware of the half-hearted ones. No desire for the word of God. That's why you don't see them here very much. They don't want to be altered or changed or disturbed. Now God bless you. God bless your assemblies. But remember, this is the mind of Christ operating. For it was Christ went through here, he was different. He spoke out. All the time he was pouring out his soul unto death, sacrificing himself. Verses 17 and 18. We'll look now at Paul, a different picture, but the same principle of sacrifice. Verse 17. Paul says, And if I be poured forth as a drink offering, that's the meaning of the word offering, upon the sacrificial service of your faith, I joy and rejoice with you all. Verse 18, mutual joy. For the same reason, do ye joy and rejoice with me. Now please, in verse 17, and now we're going to look at two offerings. We're going to look at the drink offering, and we're going to look at a burnt offering. Strange, you see? And you will notice, please, that here Paul likens himself to a drink offering. Literally, if I be poured out as a libation, if I give myself as a drink offering. Now you go back to your Old Testament and read it, and you'll find that a man would come with a burnt offering. He would offer it to God. But then with it he would pour out a drink offering. And that drink offering would express his joy and delight in God. Symbolic of a life poured out to please God. You say, what's the burnt offering? Well, look at it now. He says, I'm prepared to pour out my life as a drink offering upon the sacrificial service of your faith. What's that? Well, here's an amazing thing. The sacrifice and service of their faith, the Philippians' faith, the assembly faith, the sacrificial service is the collective activities of the local assembly at Philippi. Got it? That's the burnt offering. Now watch now. We'll see this later in chapter 4. He views the assembly at Philippi as a company of priests offering a burnt offering. That burnt offering is their service for God. You see, when you go to your Old Testament, a priest was an intelligent person who considered the result for God.
Everything that a priest did, he did for God. In so doing, he blessed men. So here is all the activity that you go in for, Sunday schools, etc., whatever you may do. It's a burnt offering going up to God. It's your sacrificial service. That service is looked upon as a burnt offering ascending to God, giving him pleasure and delight. Paul says, listen, I'm prepared to stand beside that and give my life for it. Would that be right? Tell me now. Come on. Lot of you younger folks too, are you doing anything for God in your assembly? Are you keeping out and you're not responsible? That means that you don't need to always be there. Come on. Paul says, I'm prepared to give my life for that. It is 21 years, just now at Easter, since I first came to Toronto. West and East. That I think of certain assemblies in this area as I do in other areas around the world. When I think of certain assemblies, I think of certain brethren and sisters who are giving their life for it. They're pouring out their life in it. They are possibly unknown, unrecognized, unheralded, and unsung outside the local area. But they're pouring out their life for the service of God, just where God is placed. That's a great thing. And it's their joy and delight so to do. Bless God for every one of you who find your joy and delight as you are summoned to assemble in assembly gatherings to do your bit for God, just where he placed you. Paul says, I am pouring out my life as a drink offering. I'll give myself to that and for that. Would that be right? Just where you are, is that what you're doing? Have it just a minute. You will notice what he says. He says here, and if I be poured forth as a drink offering, if I be full. Might not be, but if. Do you remember in 2 Timothy 4 when he had reached the end of life? And he's writing his last words from the dungeon. He says this. I am now ready to be poured forth as a drink offering. The time has come when he's actually going to give his life. I want you to notice in each of these occasions, he says, I'm ready to offer my life for it. And there came a time when possibly when he knew that his final appeal before Caesar was to be rejected. And within a few days or weeks, they'll take him out to the Ostian Way, 3 miles outside the ancient city of Rome, and the blade will flash and he'll be beheaded. He knows that the end of the road has come and he's going to die as a martyr. He views death and he says, I am now ready to be offered. Like his Lord, no man will take his life from him. That's not his viewpoint. He says, I'm going out to offer my life to God. I'm going to pour it out like a burnt offering. I'm happy. I'm happy to die for Christ. I'm happy to give my... Oh, brethren, there were times when Paul was world weary. He longed for the battle to be over. Longed for the days of the scarring and the beatings to be finished. Longed for the days when no longer he would bear in his body the brand marks of Christ. For his loyalty. He longed for the sunset. Longed for the evening stars. Longed for the calm of heaven and home. Longed for the rest that lies on the other side. Oh, brethren, if we work more for Christ, if we were toiling and weary, if we were battle-scarred and beaten, I tell you, we would long for heaven. Long for heaven. I am ready to give my life. The hills of Bonnie, Scotland are stained with the blood of the martyrs. Up yonder when men and women, sometimes young men and women, and young women died by fire and water for Christ. Down yonder in the southwest, in a little town called Wigtown, you can see the grave and the memorial to two women, two sisters, one older, one younger, who died for Christ. Give her up there, round there, go and see it. It was decreed they would die by drowning because they would not renege Christ. You know that word, renege, you know. They wouldn't give up their faith and conform to religious tradition that was being forced on them. Just as the tide was about to come in, they tied the older woman to a stake further out, and the younger woman to a stake just near the shore, but looking out at the older woman. And the older woman died singing. The martyrs never seemed to die grimly. Oh, I tell you, I've talked to you about assessing life and death now, but remember this, you'll get faith to die if you want it. No doubt about that. She died singing. The younger woman was watching. She's only about 18. Life's sweet, isn't it? Eh? Sweet at 58, far less 18, isn't it? Life's always sweet. The water began to lap about her feet, up to her calves, her knees, her thighs. Still she refused to recant. Up to her breasts, to her neck. And as the waters began to go over her head, the soldiers rushed in and they lifted the stake up. They gave her one last chance. Renounce your faith. What would you do? She refused. She died for Christ, to maintain the rights of Christ in his assembly. Paul says, if I be poured forth even as a martyr, I joy and rejoice with you all, and I know you'll rejoice with me. I don't understand fully why it is that we are not counted worthy to suffer for Christ. I don't know why most of the suffering should be concentrated in Eastern Europe. Over yonder, the underground church, they tell me, are praying that the church in the West might be purified by persecution. I tell you, it was in our ranks, but it would leave the gold and the wheat dried with fire. Enough. Verses 19 to 24, Timothy. Notice, please. Paul's going to talk about his fellow servant. In verse 19, he expresses his desire to send them. Got that? Verse 20, he speaks of Timothy's fitness to help them. Verse 21, he makes a general assessment. All seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's. Verse 22, he talks about a partnership in the gospel between a son and a father. Verse 23, he expresses the desire to send Timothy presently. Verse 24, he expresses the hope that he himself will get there. Now let's come back. Verse 19, I trust in the Lord Jesus. I suppose that's a similar expression to if the Lord will, if the Lord permit. I trust in the Lord to send Timothy shortly, that I may be of good comfort when I know your state. Verse 20, I have no one like-minded who will naturally care for your state. I have no one like-minded who will care with genuine feeling how you get on. Well, that's it. We're needing men that care for us. We need men that want to encourage us. Here is Paul the preacher, and he says, I'm sending Timothy, a younger preacher, and he'll care for you. Isn't it remarkable in the gifts that were given by the risen Christ in Ephesians 4? Evangelists, and then it says pastors, teachers. And by the way, that word pastor is the word for shepherd. It's not a title for a man to take. God never intended a man to be called pastor so-and-so. The word means a shepherd. It's not a title in front of your name, it's a work that you do. And he talks there about past shepherd teachers. He's talking about teachers with a shepherd heart. We come to you and we don't know you, but we love you. We want to care for you, we want to help you, with feelings for you. He says, We care with genuine feeling how you're doing as Christians, as assemblies. Paul says, I've no one else that can mirror how I feel like Timothy. That was good. Now verse 22, we'll come back to verse 21. Verse 22, he's still talking about Timothy. Now he says, you know his proven worth. Isn't that right? The proof is his proven worth. How that as a son or a child with a father he served with me in the gospel. Now notice please. Notice Paul and Timothy preaching together. Fellowship between the older and the younger. Between the mature man and the one who's not just so mature. Between wisdom and understanding in the apostle and zeal and energy in the younger man. Brethren, we're living in a day when they want to divide the old and the young, and it's unscriptural. Come on now. Paul picked up Timothy in Acts 16. For the rest of their life they worked together to show a pattern of service. Because we older ones with experience and wisdom and knowledge need the energetic activity and zeal and enthusiasm of the younger. But the younger with all that need the guidance of those who are older. So we work together in a sacred fellowship. We feed together. Oh yes, we feed together. You fed your family at the same table, didn't you? You all ate the same kind of food. I know. Now, I can't talk for here. I can talk about the old country, as you call it. I know lots of assemblies that introduce the ministry meeting for young people to find they don't attend the assembly ministry meeting. That's wrong. There are any meetings instituted that weakens the stated gatherings, then it's weakening the assembly. When the younger folks in fellowship don't appear at the normal meetings, but appear for the young folks meeting. Clear? He's showing here that there's always a fellowship that remains intact. But he says, what I'm after is this. He says, you know the proof of him. You know his proven worth. Brethren and sisters, listen. You've got to earn respect. You've got to work for people to admire you. You've got to put it in for people to recognize it. Created with us the interdoctrinal fellowship that believe certain things, and they are responsible for all the activities and responsible to gather at every gathering, not only to break bread. That's only can the assembly be strong and vital. You must prove yourself. You must prove yourself. Come again. Verse 23 and 24 is clear. He says, I'll send Timothy as soon as I know how it will go with me. He says, if they don't release me, I'll send Timothy. But if they do release me, then I'll come along with them. And that's good. He's anxious to see them. He's yearning. Now please, verse 21. He says now, all seek their own things, not the things which are Jesus Christ. Well, well. Now let's stand back. Now remember this, please. Remember that when I talk to you about this question of not seeking your own but the things of Christ, you might be prepared to turn round and say, it's all right for you, you're full time and that's your business. Okay? So I want you to understand, please, that I didn't enter full time service till 1970. When I ministered in this city in 1967 and 69, I was still working. Took my holidays to come over for 4 or 5 weeks. So you'll understand that I know what it is to work for a living, and I work for a living and preach most of my life. And all things considered, I believe that should be a normal thing. So when I say to you, look at your life and ask yourself the question, would anyone get the impression that what you're seeking is the things of Jesus Christ and you're promoting Christ's interests and not your own? Are you so immersed in your career or at your work or in your hobby? Would these things take up more time than you give to Christ? Say, I apply it to Eglinton because I'm here. You apply it where you are. Eglinton is only one midweek meeting, isn't that right? On a Tuesday night, you gather for, I take it, prayer and Bible reading. The meeting will begin at 8 o'clock, finish at 9:30. I wonder how many in fellowship in Eglinton can't spare an hour and a half out of 6 days from Monday to Saturday. Can't give an hour and a half to the Lord, who demands the collective gatherings of his people. One hour. Make the application where you are. Now, when he says, all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ, I don't think he's giving a sweeping condemnation. I don't think so. I think what he's saying is this. Listen, look out. It's a rare thing to find a person completely devoted to Christ. It's a rare thing to find the sweet savour of consecrated living. But so many Christians are out. That's what he's saying. But he says, listen, in the ultimate and in the end, the things of Jesus Christ are what counts. You work for a living and to pay the expenses. The rest of the time you devote to the interest of the man that gave his life for you and lives in heaven to sustain you. Got it? Enough. Verse 25. 25 to 30, Epaphroditus. We don't know him so well as Timothy. Verse 25, you have his character. Got that? Verses 26 to 28, Paul gives reasons for sending him back to Philippi. Verses 29 and 30, he's concerned with the reception that he'll receive and how he should be treated when he gets back home. Now, verse 25. Now he says, listen, I'm sending Epaphroditus back. Now, Epaphroditus was the person, the brother, who carried the gift, or gifts, from Philippi to Rome personally, a distance of approximately 700 miles. You can just think how long it took him. No express trains. No jumbo jets. No motor cars. He carried that sacred deposit to give it to. I'll touch on this when I do chapter 4 in the closing night, next Wednesday, if the Lord will. Now he says, I'm sending him back. But he describes them now. You will notice 5 qualities that belong to Epaphroditus. 3 of them in relation to Paul, 2 that described Epaphroditus. Paul says he is my brother, my fellow labourer, as it should read, and my fellow soldier. My brother, That's a term of relationship and affection. My fellow laborer, so he's the person that works side by side laboring in the gospel. He is my fellow soldier, so he had taken up arms for Christ. He was serving Christ on the battlefield and not in the training yard. He's not on parade. He's right in the midst of the battle. My brother. I like that. Relationship. Fellowship. I was once very touched about this verse. Way back yonder in end of August 1970, the assembly in Kilmarnock, in association with other assemblies, held a gathering in order to bid the blessing of God upon me as I went over, I went out. They invited one or two brethren to speak. And one of them was our brother Gooding, that you know, we call him AMS, Mr. Gooding. And when he rose that day, this is the verse we read. For we had preached together often, even for a number of weeks on occasions in the gospel. It was very touching when he began to speak of my brother, my fellow laborer, my fellow soldier. That intimacy of relationship between us continues cordially and warmly to this day. There's no man I admire more than Arthur Gooding. My fellow laborer, says Paul about this man. This was the brother that had learned to live and work with somebody else. It's easy working your own, you know. You can just do what you like, so to speak. You understand? When you have to work with someone else and be disciplined, and very often submit your mind to the others, very difficult. You know that. You find that even in assembly life, very difficult to live with each other. They didn't learn very much about it at Corinth, and we haven't learned a great deal about it either, maybe. Fellow soldier, have you got it? But he says, notice now, please, my messenger, and he that's minister to my wants. Now that word messenger is the word for apostle. But as I told you, there are only 13 official apostles, so now it's used in its secondary sense as a messenger. He says, he's the man that came to me. It was your messenger. You sent him. And he came in all the dignity of an ambassador for Christ. But he says, he's the man that ministered to my wants. I like that. Just to do the ordinary. Just to do the common things. Just to be beside Paul and meet his needs in whatever way he wished. And that's good. We can't all be preachers. The spotlight can't shine upon everybody publicly. Just as great a reward for Epaphroditus, if he did it and did it well, as for Paul. Isn't that right? Didn't the man with the two talents get the same reward correspondingly as the man with the five? Come on. Come on. It's not my fault, brother, if I've only two talents and you five. That's not my fault. That's sovereignty. That's the way God ordered it. But if I use my two talents to the full, I'll get the same reward as you when you use your five. Got that? That's a big encouragement, isn't it? Come again. Verses 26 to 28, he's sending them back. Now verses 26 and 27, his first reason is because Epaphroditus was longing after them. He was homesick and he was very ill. Like that? Verse 28, he says, I sent him diligently, carefully, quickly, for your sake, that you might rejoice when you see him. And finally he says, I sent him for my sake, that I may be the less sorrowful. Are still of the sorrow of imprisonment, but less worry now that I know that he's home safe with you. Come again. Verse 26, 27, he longed after you all and was full of heaviness, full of distress, because ye had heard that he had been sick. He was worried about them worrying about him. Why, that's good, isn't it? Verse 27, he said he was sick nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him. And not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. That is, he had the sorrow of imprisonment, but he didn't want the sorrow of Epaphroditus dying in Rome. Is that right? Now, so he says, I sent him to you. Now, I'll come back to that. You'll leave verse 27 for a moment, will you, please? Now, quickly, verses 29 and 30. Now he says, you receive him with gladness. Hold him in honor. Give him a place of reputation. Because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, pouring out his life to supply your lack of service toward me. That is, to supply what you couldn't supply because you were so far away. So that they didn't want to serve Paul, but he was doing it on their behalf. And doing it on their behalf as a messenger, he had given himself so utterly to it that he had reached well nigh the portals of death. Finally, as I draw to a close, note please, will you, that all sickness is not because of sin. Notice please too, verse 27, he was nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him. So it was the mercy of God that healed him, not Paul. Indicating that God does not always miraculously heal. Now my time's up fully. I would like to have spoken to you on chastening. To show you that all sickness is not due to sin. For instance, chastening comes in three ways. It can be retributive. You can suffer for your sins. David's the example. Chastening can be educative. The example is Job. Chastening can be preventative. The example is Paul. He had a thorn in the flesh to keep him humble. Is that right? It's perfectly clear as time went on that not even Paul was healing in every circumstance. For instance, Timothy had a weak stomach. 1 Timothy 5, Paul didn't heal him. Paul had a thorn in the flesh that was physical that God gave to keep him humble. No one would be allowed to heal it. Epaphroditus was sick nigh unto death. No, Paul never healed him. 2 Timothy 4, Trophimus have I left at Miletum sick. Paul never healed him. It's not God's mind always to heal. There are deep lessons to be learned along the line of suffering. Understand? So may the Lord bless his word.